Welcome to Happily Ever After is just the beginning. Keeping your relationship not just together, but happy, and we mean truly happy, is part art and part science. You've come to the right place. Here's your host, Leslie Dorries.
Most of us have a love-hate relationship with the idea of being vulnerable. We want others to open up and share their deepest thoughts and feelings with us, but then we go into a cold sweat when we're asked to do the same. When we experience someone else being vulnerable, we often admire their courage, but then we judge ourselves as weak when we show signs of the exact same behavior. And a less positive reaction that unfortunately isn't as rare as it could be is when we react to someone else's display of vulnerability with fear and anxiety. And this is often what happens between partners, and if I'm being honest, I've been guilty of it myself. So given this confusing reality, is there really a way to step into our vulnerability without overwhelming panic coming along for the ride? Well, today my guest, a former lieutenant with the New York Fire Department and fellow marriage and family therapist George Faller, is here to provide some answers. So George, thank you so much for coming on the show and talking about both this timely and really important topic.
Well, thank you for having me, Leslie. I couldn't agree more. This is a really huge topic.
You know, and part of what prompted this was I read an article that you wrote for the Psychotherapy Networker called When Male Partners Won't Open Up, and you made a statement that grabbed my attention. You said, and I quote, vulnerability is the language of emotionally connected beings. It's like, got to that sentence and went, okay. So, you know, why is this so? Why, you know, what is this about this emotionally connected beings? And if this is true, why is vulnerability avoided at all costs?
Big question. All right.
Let's just jump right in.
Yeah. I loved your introduction saying vulnerability, this is a confusing reality. And I think we have to start off with understanding as therapists how mismatched we are with working with most men who don't want to do vulnerability. You know, we have this image of vulnerability, which I wrote about, you know, in that line, that it's the language of emotionally connected beings.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so we love this stuff as therapists. We want to go there. It makes us feel like we're doing our work well. And, you know, we see the fireworks that happen when people respond to each other there. But mm-hmm. I think we lose our balance a little bit. So I just want to start off by zooming out and saying, you know, the original definition of vulnerability, if you read it in a dictionary, says being open to attack or weakness.
No wonder we don't like it.
Exactly. You know, and we're trying to expand that definition, which is really important, but to just honor, you know, where it comes from. We have really not want to do vulnerability. You know, as a species, you know, we wouldn't have survived if we didn't learn how to turn off feelings and to take care of, you know, be calm under pressure. So the first thing I'd like to do is remind myself when I'm working with someone who doesn't want to do vulnerability, that they have really good reasons why they don't want to do vulnerability.
Oh, absolutely. And I know this is an important word, there is no shame in not wanting to do vulnerability because it is scary.
And it's more than just not scary, because most people see it as defensive and protection, which it is.
Yes.
But it's also how people feel good about themselves. It's how they fit in. It's how they get promoted. You know, I knew myself, if I was crawling into a fire, I don't want the firefighter next to me expressing their vulnerabilities and talking about how scared it is and how hot they are, how hot it is, right? This ability to turn off your feelings, to gain distance from your feelings, cognitively focus on the task and take care of business is hugely mm-hmm. valued, right? So these people feel really good about themselves in a lot of settings for being able not to do vulnerability. And we want to start off by honoring that, because you're going to see more of the person you're sitting opposite of than just this person who's protecting themselves.
Right, and I think maybe this is one of the struggles, which we're definitely going to be talking about later, about how that position of protection and disconnection from feelings can be misinterpreted, or especially as part of a couple.
Right. Yeah, and then we get to how do we learn the protective part of vulnerability. So I imagine, you know, I had a client the other day tell me a story. I mean, she was a little girl. Her parents were not responsive at all to her.
Mm-hmm.
And she remembers it 4 years old, really wanting balloons for her birthday.
Yep.
And her mom saying, absolutely not, you can't have it. The worst part isn't the no. The worst part is that mom couldn't read her disappointment, her sadness. And if a parent can't repair, what you are teaching your kid to do is to resign themselves from doing vulnerability. What's the point of doing it and going to these emotions if it's not going to be responded to? So it starts the creation of these walls that, you know, and walls are indiscriminate. To keep out the bad, they're also going to keep out the good. And, you know, it starts to deaden the heart over years. So, you know, imagine a little boy being told by, you know, his dad, if they're crying,
mm-hmm.
I'll give you something to cry about if I see more of that.
Well, you say that, and that brings up, my father used to say that to me all the time, and I swore up one side and down the other that whatever else I said to my children, those words were never coming out of my mouth. Because I remember, I mean, 'cause I'm thinking, well, if I'm crying, I obviously think I have something good to cry about. And, yeah, it is that rejection of stop it.
Yes, stop it. And what the science is saying is if stop it is consistent enough, not only will you not share, but you will not know who you are in those sad places. There's an ambiguity that develops. So a lot of times these withdrawers or these retreaters that don't do vulnerability, we think like they know their whole inner world. They just don't want to share it. And that's actually not true. They don't know their inner world because they haven't been given this space, this responsiveness to put words to organize their experience.
Well, and that's something I run into a lot when I'm working with couples and especially with men, because they say they don't know what they're feeling, and that drives their wives crazy, but that's actually true. They really don't know what they're feeling because they've been taught not to.
Yes, and that's why I supervise lots of therapists. When a man says, I don't know what I'm feeling, I'm like, you're right on track. You're right where you're supposed to be. They're trying to put words to something they never put words to. They're not trying to be difficult or resistant. It's not a sign that you're failing as a therapist. You are right on track. You just have to learn now how to open up that space to help them put words to what anybody would feel in those places. And I think that's the target, what we're working towards, why I say it's the, you know, the language of emotional connection is embedded in that vulnerability is our deepest, longest desires and wants. I mean, it's one thing to be loved when we get it right and we're performing. It's another to be loved when we're failing or we're insecure and we're doubting. It's the closest we're ever going to get to unconditional love.
And that's really important, because also is in the article, as part of this quote, you go on to say that, again, I'm quoting, vulnerable states bring forth new opportunities for deep intimacy and transformation, especially in work with couples. And I think that's exactly what you just said. And, you know, and part of this is you're saying we're right on track. If somebody, especially, it's usually the man, but not always, recognizes that they don't know what they're feeling, most of the time there's a willingness to learn, provided it's approached in the right way. So why does it then go off the rails so badly when somebody is actually right on, teetering on the edge of, is it okay for me to be vulnerable? Is it okay for me to go there?
Well, and that's why you got to understand the dynamics of the person they're with or the dynamics of the couple itself. I mean, when you turn the bad guy, in this case, who never wants to talk, into a stranger, it's still hard for the partner to trust it, you know, and how the partner tends to show mistrust is through questions and anxiety, which is going to elicit more defensiveness and walls. So couples are going to protect themselves in really predictable ways. What they wind up doing is choosing what has worked in their past, and which makes absolute sense. But unfortunately, what they do to protect themselves really doesn't work. It's the worst thing possible for the other partner. And they, you know, they get caught in these feedback loops that are pretty predictable. One of the first couples I ever saw, the wife came in, you know, saying, I've been waiting 6 weeks to talk to you. I finally get a chance. I read all the books and, you know, I really, really, really want to get a chance to fix all this. And, you know, my husband never talks and I really don't know what to do. And I tried everything. I watched Dr. Phil and she had this pace that never stopped for like 30 minutes. I was waiting for her to take a breath, but she never took a breath. Right. But her complaint is her husband never talks. And I'm saying to myself, well, how can he talk if you never stop talking? Right. So it's trying to get both people to see the good reasons. She's so anxious because she wants a response, and her way of trying to get a response is to push. But she's married to a guy who kind of pulls away to protect himself. And, you know, they just feed each other's protection.
An important thing to understand, that we get into this pattern, into this flow with our partner, and don't necessarily, like I tell people, they can give me a laundry list of what their partner is doing that is creating challenges in the relationship, and then my question to them is, yes, and what's your part in it? Because we don't see that it's a dynamic, it's an ebb and flow, that we give something and we get something back.
Exactly. I tell couples all the time, it's really, keep this simple. It's the success of any relationship is based on the quality of the engagements, right? And what you start to see over time with most couples is because they can't share parts of themselves. They can't do vulnerability. They have to hide parts of who they are and what's happening. And there's less and less and less to engage. So the distance just increases over time. People think they get separated, divorced, because they don't love each other. It's not actually true. It's not about love. It just has to be about the defensiveness and distance. And the quality of the engagement has just gotten, you know, too far apart.
Well, and it's interesting because one of my early couples, I loved them to death. They were like the perfect couple, that if I could just like repeat them all over the place, it would be great, because they were not in too bad of shape and willing to actually do some exploration. But she comes bouncing into my office one day, and she says, I had an epiphany. And I said, great, what was it? And she said, relationships aren't natural. And I burst out laughing, and I said, well, where did you get the idea that they were? But I think that's what most people think. We fall in love, which is, people don't necessarily understand that that's a huge part of that is a biochemical process. But it's so easy in the beginning, and then, you know, we think it should stay easy, and then when it doesn't, we're thinking, oh my gosh, this is the wrong person, or they don't love me, or they're this, or they're that, when it's actually, no, this is actually the normal way relationships go, but we never go past the in-love stage.
Right, that's why it's nuts that we don't talk about this stuff in schools and educate our kids at an early age. I mean, it's, people fight over, the only difference between the best couples and the worst couples, so much of John Gottman's research, is they all fight over the same things. The only difference is, you know, good couples have this ability to repair. They notice distance and mistrust growing, and they learn to reach towards each other and create that safety. And there's so much science behind how to do this and how to make this work.
Well, I know that's the frustrating thing that you and I run into, is that we as a field know this, but we have not yet been able to get it out into the general populace. I mean, I think that nobody should be allowed to graduate from high school without a course in relationships, because it isn't just our romantic relationships. The rules apply to all relationships,
exactly.
But this is where, you know, it comes out more, is in this relationship where we've decided we're going to spend the rest of our lives, you know, one-on-one, intimately with another human being.
And if you think about that, I mean, especially a lot of the younger generation believe that, you know, maybe marriage, say, for example, is outdated because, you know, 40% or 50% of marriages are ended in divorce. You know, I like to turn that upside down. I'm amazed that, you know, more than 50% of relationship lasts for a lifetime without any rule book. You basically meet somebody, you fall in love with, you don't really get help to make sense of it, and you stay with that person forever. I mean, that's amazing that many people make it. It's, to me, that's evidence that there's something about this longing to kind of be with somebody, to be in a relationship, that's so deeply ingrained that we do this crazy thing and we get into relationships. I know when I was growing up, I made a promise myself. I wasn't going to get married. Why? You know, I could do whatever I want and live as a bachelor and have fun, no pressure. That sounded great to me. And then I met my wife and got married. So there's some really strong pull here that, you know, I think we're finally starting to crack the code of love and start understanding these powerful longings. It's that bypasses our thinking and kind of pushes us in this direction of relationships.
Well, and I do think that that is the pull that we all, I don't want to say struggle with, we all face, because we are, human beings are designed to live in community. We are not designed to live out in the woods on our own, you know, by ourselves. But it is this ebb and flow, this how do we make this work? How do we not get subsumed, I call it, by the blob of marriage, you know, back to the old Steve McQueen blob movie, and still maintain who we are but be part of something bigger. And that's the challenge, and vulnerability plays a huge role in being able to do that successfully.
Yes, that's the music. And we just have to learn to tune into it.
Which is what you and I are trying to do today. And I just want to remind people that this is Happily Ever After is just the beginning on webtalkradio.net. I'm Leslie Dorries, and I'm having a truly remarkable discussion about how vulnerability is completely misunderstood with my guest, former New York Fire Department lieutenant and fellow marriage family therapist, George Faller. And, you know, the idea of being vulnerable is terrifying for most of us. But honestly, there's no way to get the kind of relationship most of us want without it. So if you want to have a deeper, more connected marriage, you can. So I want you to gather your love and courage and give me a call or send me an email and schedule a free, no obligation, Be a Hero Husband strategy session. You can reach me at area code 919-924-0463, or you can send me an email at Leslie, L-E-S-L-I, at theherohusbandproject.com. So hopefully, as we work through this, people will be able to understand what's going on, not fight it so much, because this is a natural process, scary though it is. It's like being a parent. It's a natural process, but incredibly scary. So I want to get back to talking with George about, you know, vulnerability and what goes on with it. And, you know, you're in a perfect position because you came up through a very traditional masculine profession, the fire department. That's not to say anything about the women who are also in that field. But what makes it more challenging for men to be vulnerable? And what is it that their partners are doing that make it harder for men to open up?
Well, we're going to overgeneralize here, but I do think there are studies out that are watching parents interact with their sons and daughters. And at the earliest age, you know, parents' interactions with daughters, you know, communication is a way of checking in, of trying to connect, of, you know, how you look, what's going on. It's a way of engaging. And mm-hmm. from the earliest age, communication with boys is really trying to get them to do something or trying to not get them to do something. So they're already learning from the earliest age that communication is a means to an end. It's, you know, it's focused on what you have to do and performance. And I think that's a big part of understanding why men typically don't want to do vulnerability, because they're not paying attention to it. What makes them feel safe, the rules that they are given is, you know, perform. If you do well, you're going to fit in, you're going to be accepted, the world's going to be safe. And that's why they're susceptible to criticism and a message that they're doing it wrong. The Achilles heel is the message that they're failing. But if they're failing or they start to feel some kind of criticism, that's why they want to fix things. They're focusing on what they need to do to get back on track. So if all your focus is on performance and fixing, it's not on you. It's not on your own inner world. And so when you're asking them to put words to their vulnerability, it's not on their radar screen. I mean, it's there. It's there in a deeper way, and we're trying to help them tune into it. It's impossible to stop emotion as it is stopping ourselves from sneezing. I mean, it's there, but if you just don't tune into it, it's hard to put it into words. So I think that's the starting point to say why this is so difficult. Their view is focusing on performance and the other and outside themselves, and how do we normalize that and honor that and get them to start paying attention to them, what's happening on the inside.
Well, and I think that's one of the things that it's very distressing when I hear it. And I'm not exactly sure, maybe you have some more insight onto why it is this way and where it comes from, but there is a lot of criticism that goes on in relationships very frequently, you know, women to men, where, you know, the men, I mean, I joke with some of my clients about, well, he's not washing the baby right. And my response is the baby's head above water? I mean, you know, it's like, okay, if he's got the baby underneath the water, maybe you're okay. But then it's also, how long has, I mean, does this man have hygiene issues, or is he able to take a shower and come out clean? But it's this, almost this constant judgment about, well, this isn't done right or that isn't done right, when in actuality it's being done differently.
Yes, and I think that's the beauty of being a couples therapist, and you could hold two truths. It always makes sense when you understand the context. So, you know, for many women who are critical, you know, I think I always try to resist the urge to say, can't you see that's not helping, and try to walk in their shoes and understand they just deal with threat by trying to approach the threat and talk about it. And their anxiety is just a way to kind of fix things and move things and motivate things. It's just it's a very different type of energy than an energy like these male withdrawers who they see threat and they want to pull away. They want it to calm down. They want to come back later and not make things worse. But they just kind of keep feeding each other. So that wife that sees their baby, you know, it could be done in a different way. It creates an anxiety that she's trying to get relieved by saying, hey, you're doing it wrong, because if you do it this way, I will feel better. What they don't recognize in how they're dealing with their anxiety actually makes their partner want to go further away from them, not kind of do what they want them to do.
Well, and I find it very interesting that you say this, because it's very true, and I don't think many people recognize that a lot of these behaviors are about reducing our own anxiety. But then, of course, we have to recognize that we're anxious in the first place.
Exactly. And who helps us to pay attention? I mean, if you're that anxious, pursuing wife and your partner's always leaving, you don't really have anywhere to go with that anxiety. Mm-hmm. You know, but for me, what we're focused on today is actually that moment the husband retreats because they're trying to go away to kind of self-soothe, to get away from the threat. Actually, that moment right before they leave is when they're feeling the most anxious and nobody even sees it. Nobody ever puts words to that moment. It is their moment of greatest need and no one even sees it. It's easy to see the wife's kind of criticism or tears or energy because they're expressing it. And mm-hmm. because these withdrawers don't express it, nobody ever sees it. So that's what I'm help trying to put words to. That moment right before you retreat, who sees you?
Well, and that's an interesting component because I think a related response or is the opposite, where maybe I don't have a retreater, but I got a fighter. That somebody, that they're going to come back at me. But the source of it is exactly the same. It's still that inner anxiety of not knowing what to do, not having it be quote unquote right, but being able to have the capacity to stay. And so this is, you know, so what needs to happen to change this? How can we as partners, friends, and professionals make this different?
Right. Well, first of all, I just want to backtrack a second. The actions could look very similar because these withdrawn men who don't do emotions can really use anger too. Mm-hmm. But the intent of their anger is different. They're using anger to kind of ward off these feelings of failure. They're trying to get anger to create distance. Where this pursuer, this anxious, say, wife, her anger and criticism is actually trying to create closeness and change. So the intent of the anger, though it looks the same, means very different things. So I think that's where they need help trying to put words to what they're trying to kind of accomplish and understand that inner world. But your other question really goes to the heart of the matter. I mean, how do we change this? What breaks my heart in working with, and I do so much work with the military and kind of traveling all over the place, and you know, this ability to turn off your emotions. How we learn to do that is as kids, when our needs are not being met. If you go to Mary Ainsworth's A Strange Situation, that avoidance strategy, you know, when a stranger walks into the room, they don't even seek comfort. They just keep playing, right? That they've already learned not to depend on people, that people let you down, that the best thing that you can do is keep to yourself, you know. And then this adaptive strategy is really reinforced in the world, and they find careers where people say it's great, you don't do emotions, and then all of a sudden, you know, they're in relationships and people are telling them there's something wrong with them because they don't do emotions, when they're really just following the rules. So, you know, how do you change that? Is you really got to start to get them to look at themselves. And the tragedy for me is that when they are actually in these moments of need, nobody sees them. They're left alone in their places to deal with their insecurities, their vulnerabilities. No wonder why they just want to get away from it. They're making a choice to not feel pain and fear because they're always alone in it. So that becomes a strategy, which really breaks my heart that they're never confident. I think I have two sons that if they were that way, I would do anything to try to kind of be there for them in those places. But even the part two that makes it worse is because they've tried to outrun their own pain. When their partners want help in their pain, what empathy is, you got to feel with. To feel my wife's pain, I have to be willing to feel my own pain. And because I'm trying to avoid my own pain, it also makes sense why I'm going to try to avoid my wife's pain. So I'm not only am I set up to be alone, I'm set up to actually fail my wife in her pain too. And that's a pretty crappy setup. So the antidote to that is having them experience the value of vulnerability. You can't talk them into it, try to coach them to get better at giving it to their partner. You actually have to teach their nervous system the value of being in these places of fear and pain and having someone else come alongside and support and comfort you in that place. And all of a sudden, their body starts to learn those longings that they've always had to be comforted in these places start to come online again. When they start to experience the benefits of it, it makes sense why it becomes so much easier for them to give that to others.
So how do we help? Because I hear a lot, especially when a lot of times men with their wives, when their wives are in pain and, you know, or they're, you know, they're upset, they're crying. And how do we help people move past that? The fact that this person over here is in pain doesn't necessarily mean that I'm responsible for it, because I think that's also something that I run into, that, oh, if my partner is upset, I did something to cause it. Now, you know, I talk with people about, and I don't know if you're familiar with Terry Real's work, but the idea, and the first time I ever heard this, I went, yeah, that's not true, about I feel something, and I'm feeling it because of the situation that I'm in, but my partner isn't causing me to feel this way. I'm somewhat choosing to feel this way, which is a very complicated way of thinking about this.
Yeah, that's too
complicated
for me. But I think there's a... Yeah, go ahead.
But this idea that if my partner is upset, it's because it's directly because of something I did, and therefore I'm wrong, I'm bad, and I want to go away, that my anxiety goes up and I want to go away from it.
Right. I think there's a simpler solution to it. You're 100% right. If I see my wife's tears and those tears make me feel like they're my fault, it's going to block my empathy.
Okay.
Right, it's going to trigger that part of me that feels like I'm failing, because that's what I've been trained to do. If I was doing the right thing and a good job, my wife wouldn't be crying. If I was performing well, she'd be happy. So her tears don't pull my empathy. They start to trigger my failure, right? But I think the critical question is, who sees my failure? Who helps me see? And this is so counterintuitive, but the solution to the pain lies in the pain. You got to get withdrawers to head into the places they want to avoid, because in that place you're going to find more self-compassion and the partner's compassion, the therapist's compassion, God's compassion, whatever I can pull in to start to get these withdrawers to experience that this natural process that when struggling, when we need people the most and they show up, you find connection and redemption in these critical moments. They have to experience it if they're going to actually be able to give it. So that,
I guess I have I pay attention to words, because for me there's a lot of meaning in the words, and there are certain words that I don't particularly care for. And failure is one of them, because that's a really negatively charged word. And we're talking about it, and this is what happens with a lot of people, is they're feeling like they're failing. And that obviously creates anxiety and a bunch of other responses. So is it changing the word failing? That are these guys failing, or is it just something they don't know?
I wish we could give them words and talk them out of the feeling, you know, but my experience is if you're so conditioned, the word really captures their experience.
Okay.
So if my son hits a home run to win the game, it's so easy to love him. But if he strikes out to lose the game, he's going to feel like he disappointed people and he failed, you know, and yet that's the moment where he's going to need my love the most. And that's the moment where he tends not to get it. Most of these men are not being loved or responded to in these deep places. They're doing everything they can to hide them and get away from them. So I don't see the word failure as anything but a doorway. You know, if I could just meet them in that place where they feel like they're failing, you know, they can get a sense of responsiveness if they're willing to head towards it instead of trying to talk them out of it. You know, well, and again, if my son could experience, he strikes out and loses and feels horrible, but he feels my love and acceptance in those places. It's, you know, it's one thing to be loved when we're getting it right, but when we're loved, in a, you know, there's no stronger force on this planet than that unconditional love of somebody being alongside you. You know, not trying to talk you out of it, but just meeting you in that place and seeing you. And I think that starts to turn that failure, which we think is such a bad thing, into something beautiful, because it strengthens the trust and the love in a relationship. And these men just don't know how to do it. You know, they just see failure as something that's horrible to avoid at all costs. And I think I'm just like we started this conversation around vulnerability. I think if we it's really a paradox. Yes, there's a lot of pain and negativity, but there's also an opportunity for this transformation and growth. And to not have the negative, they also lose the chance for the positive.
Well, and I like you bringing up this idea of unconditional love, because that's what everybody says they want, which I don't disagree, and we all want to feel loved unconditionally, but sometimes it's a lot harder for us to actually love unconditionally, because, you know, whether it's our child or our partner or whatever, that, you know, if my son strikes out and feels bad, and you see this all the time in sports events. I mean, you see it after the Super Bowl. You see it after, you know, the World Series, when you have the team that wins, they're all excited and confetti and everything, and then you see the other team, you know, shattered. I mean, you know, just completely devastated. And I don't know whether – you know, I mean, and you see them in tears, and nobody gives them a hard time about that most of the time in the moment. But then there's the expectation, we'll get over it, it's over and done with, and move on, which I think is also part of the problem. But how do we sit with our own anxiety when somebody that we love so deeply is in that place of failure?
Yeah, we don't know how to do that well as a society. I mean, take parents, for example. Most parents, when they see their kids in that place, just try to talk them out of it, reassure them, tell them they shouldn't feel that way. But really all that does is make them feel more alone in it. Really what I'm trying to get couples to do is to kind of be in that hole together. If a partner's not jumping in and going to be lost, they can take a ladder down there, ropes, you know, to climb back out. But just to allow people to experience that in these dark moments, somebody else can be alongside. And how we experience that failure, that pain, qualitatively is so different than when we're alone facing it. You know, I'll never forget, I worked with a Navy SEAL, and this guy grew up in a family of origin, foster care. He never had a secure attachment. It was abuse and violence, and it was really pretty terrible. And then he goes to the military, and you know, it's good that he can turn off his feelings, and it kind of works well for him. Then he gets into a marriage, and he, you know, he wants something good, but he don't know how to make it work, and it's a disaster, and there's affairs and addictions and violence. I mean, it's just a train wreck all across the board. And I'm doing a session with this guy for the first time, and he says, George, I know a lot of people say they don't do emotions. I just want to let you know I don't have any emotions.
Right.
You know, so vulnerability is not really a great option for this guy. You know, I'm working, I'm doing it, and I'm trying to see if I can get something, you know, some handle, some emotion to work with. I'm not getting anything. Then all of a sudden, this man talks about his daughter. And I'm like, oh, can you tell me more about, you know, your daughter, Mary? And he, all of a sudden, something shifts in this man. And he says to me, oh, she's the greatest thing that ever happens to me. I sit down at night on her bed, I rub her hair, and I read her a story about the knight and the dragon. I'm her knight, and I'll always protect her and love her. And I read her this story, and I kiss her on the head, and I rub her hair, and she falls asleep. How the heck does this man know how to do that? No one ever did that for him.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he perfectly knows how to love his daughter in these places. I mean, it's within all of us. This is our native language. So that's the good news for me. Sometimes I work with people, and it's really hard to access because they've had to survive for so long.
Sure.
But I know deep down that that vulnerability is our natural language, that there's a part of this man's heart that has always been longing to connect with people in their pain, and to have somebody do that for him. Now, that's not a sign of weakness. That's actually our greatest strength, that we can kind of become part of something bigger than ourselves in those moments.
Well, and I love that you put that out there, because that's frequently the way in, that what we feel for ourselves is one thing, but what we feel for our children is really, I think, that doorway into it, just like you're explaining with your client. And I think this is a fantastic topic. We could keep talking about this. We need to keep talking about this. Unfortunately, we're out of time.
Right.
But can you please share some information about where people can learn more about this whole topic, you, how to approach this? Because I think you're a prime example of, you know, what we're trying to accomplish and how to do it better.
Right. Well, I just like to end by saying we're not trying to turn these men into women. What we're going to do is talk about their feelings. It's all about flexibility. All the research on leadership, it says the same thing, that, you know, when you want to take care of business and turn off your emotions, to be able to do that is the most adaptive thing you could do, and that's great. And then those moments where you can let your guard down and let somebody in who has your back. I mean, the only reason I go into a fire is because I'm going in with other people. So I just want to make sure we're clear about that, because a lot
Absolutely.
Of men are reluctant to come to therapy because they think it's about turning them into these crying beings, and it's really just about sharing that truth. It doesn't even need to be tears.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But if people want more information, I just came out with a book last year called Sacred Stress. You can find that on Amazon or sacredstress.com. It's all about my stories with 9/11 and how I've worked with military and men to try to put words to these things that a lot of times we don't get help. And, you know, the success as we have when we do that. Or people can just reach out to me at georgefaller, FALLER.com.
Well, terrific. Because what I want people to understand, what we've been talking about today, is to love is to be vulnerable. So the alternative to vulnerability is isolation and loneliness. And most of us don't really want that, but we struggle with the willingness to be vulnerable. We're, you know, it creates the very thing we're trying to avoid when we back away from being vulnerable. And the answer, as we've been talking about, is to create a space where it is safe, truly safe, to be open. And this takes both knowledge and skill, but the payoff is greater than you can ever imagine. And hopefully you'll keep listening to the show, keep learning, keep willing to be open, and until next week, stay loving.